Thanks so much, and thanks to all of you for sticking around. I know how perilously close we are getting to happy hour, so this is great to see such enthusiasm this late in the day. I'd like to we had initially had a different order, but I think this actually works well because some of the points that Greg brought up and John brought up I think can be reflected in the approach that I'd like to present today, which really focuses on, you know, how do we operationalize some of these concepts that we have in epidemiology of vulnerability, of population in place, understand how climate change, climate variability all interact along with built environment to give us some direction in how we go about responding to climate change. And as a starting point, it's important to mention the conclusions of the IPCC fourth assessment report. The fifth assessment report is just starting, and it's going to finish in about 5 years, hopefully, not sooner. But the IPCC fourth assessment report really was a watershed event for public health and the impact sectors because it largely put to rest in the scientific community critical questions about whether climate change is happening, its attribution, and whether or not we need to adapt. And basically the findings are warming's unequivocal, and physical and biological systems on all parts of the planet, not just the poles, are being affected. But perhaps most importantly is the critical understanding that we are already committed to more warming in the coming decades, no matter what our choices in mitigation are now. If we were somehow successfully reduced our emissions to zero today, the lifespan of these greenhouse gases in the environment commit us to more warming in the coming decades. Not to mean we shouldn't address mitigation, but certainly adaptation is required. It's fundamentally necessary for public health. And some of these changes in climate that we're going to see are going to affect health in a wide variety of pathways, either directly through the impact of heat waves and storms, and perhaps most importantly and most difficult is understanding the indirect effect that climate change has on altering ecosystem dynamics, ecosystem functioning, and how those interact with the distribution of infectious diseases. So there are other trends that we have to consider as well in addition to climate, and this is one thing Greg brought up earlier, and it's the influence of cities and population dynamics, population and demographic change as it intersects with climate change. And certainly cities and climate are co-evolving in a manner that will place more populations at risk. For the first time in human history, we are an urban species. This is a dramatically rapid shift from less than 30% in the 1950s. I think I got that right. And not only are we a rapidly urbanizing population, moving into environments that are completely anthropogenic, but we're also an aging population, and dramatically so. If you look at population pyramids projected to the 2050s, it's no longer a pyramid, it's a block. And advanced age, as we know from epidemiologic studies, is associated risk factor with many of these climate-sensitive health outcomes. But in addition to becoming a more urbanized society and an aging society, those converge in an environment where the climate influences are intensified through and magnified through the influence of the built environment. This is a nighttime satellite image of Phoenix in, I'm not sure what year, but Phoenix has a pronounced urban heat island effect. It's in the Chihuahuan Desert, and surrounding areas typically cool considerably at night, up to a 50-degree temperature shift from what they call the diurnal temperature range. Well, Phoenix had its record nighttime low in 2007 of 99 degrees. Almost no cooling is happening at night, and this not only drives vulnerability through an increased demand on the energy infrastructure, but it also intensifies those exposures that we know, temperature that related to poor air quality and heat exposure that are critically important to address. This is an example of a study, one type of vulnerability assessment, that tried to understand the heterogeneity of the urban heat island within Phoenix. This is Phoenix. And some folks in the room can, you know, talk about this for days, I know. But I just wanted to point out one finding from this study. And it's important because it shows the importance of place and population with regards to these exposures. These folks, this is Sharon Harlan and colleagues, looked at temperature every 5 minutes for a whole year in different neighborhoods throughout Phoenix that were characterized by different socioeconomic status, et cetera. I'm going to just compare two of these, and that's the historic angle of Phoenix, which is a very nice part of town, a lot of landscaping, nice houses, 100% prevalence of air conditioning, and a lot of green space. Compare that just up the street to the Black Canyon Freeway neighborhood, which is on the side of I-17, almost no green space and vegetation, apartment complexes, high prevalence of evaporative cooling versus air conditioning, and it's low socioeconomic status. It's the immigrant landing spot in Phoenix. Well, if we characterize mean summertime temperature, we notice it's about 7 degrees difference. Not terribly startling and not all that concerning, but when we look at peak temperatures and times of maximum temperature, those differences jump dramatically. And this shows the effect of the mediating influence of green space evapotranspiration on fluctuations in heat exposure. Not only are these folks in the Black Canyon Freeway neighborhood exposed to more heat, but they're also less capable of dealing with it. It's highlighting not only the social vulnerability to heat, but also the influence of place on enhancing those exposures. So these are starting points for us looking at how we address these vulnerabilities. And if we look at heat wave studies, numerous epi studies on heat waves starting in St. Louis in 1980 and up, there's been numerous risk factors identified for hyperthermia, ranging from individual level characteristics such as underlying medical conditions. And we could replace hyperthermia with a wide variety of health outcomes and understand how the individual vulnerability then intersects with community characteristics. In the case of heat waves, it's access to cooling shelters and transportation to those cooling shelters, but also neighborhood characteristics like we described below. Land use, land cover, albedo, crime rate, and your ability to open your windows up at night, etc. That was important for Chicago. Housing type and the local influence of the urban heat island. These are all starting places for our concepts of vulnerability. So I'd like to take this as a starting place and highlight some of our activities at CDC and how we're trying to address some of these core challenges that climate change brings in a new program that we've launched this month. It's called the Climate Ready States and Cities Initiative. And our main project through that is funding through a cooperative agreement, 8 states and 2 local health departments, 2 cities, to engage in adaptation planning. And some of the grantees are in the room. To develop strategies and a methodology for public health engagement with climate change and pursuing an adaptation plan. Those projects will be launched in December, but in order to support those initiatives and develop well-defined data-driven strategies for those adaptation efforts, we also have another arm of that initiative that is to develop decision support tools. It's a fundamental role of CDC to provide the research and the development of these decision support tools that include vulnerability mapping, like I'll talk about today, but also include a wide variety of other materials, such as messaging, training opportunities, and training programs. We discussed that a little bit this morning. And so I'd like to give you a flavor of the types of approaches that we're undertaking in order to build capacity to identify these vulnerable places and populations. The first example is a study that we're conducting with colleagues at Indiana University and NASA, looking at the use of remotely sensed data to develop and enhance heat watch warning systems. These are the primary alert mechanisms that are used in about 20 U.S. cities for identifying the meteorologic characteristics associated with excess mortality. So this is a health watch warning system associated with extreme heat. They've identified meteorologic characteristics that are associated with, this is not just temperature, but a larger, they call it a synoptic weather classification system that is intended to get a better sense of the mortality temperature relationship. And our approach was to combine data on a number of different levels, starting with meteorological data, adding mortality data that we derive from death certificates, and temperature data on land surface temperature that's remotely sensed. We assume that increased surface thermal characteristics, as identified remotely, and I'll show this in a minute, lead to an increased risk of death in that location, and we use a number of spatial analytic techniques and statistical techniques to identify which of these convergent locations are actually more risk. And the idea is to develop spatially specific risk maps for several U.S. cities. Second phase of the study, which I won't talk about, really is testing these, doing focus group testing on the utility and applicability of these approaches in their jurisdictions, because what we're after is decision support tools, and if we don't understand the decision context, we're not doing much. So the first idea is to develop this model of exposure and vulnerability, and through estimating land surface temperature using these NASA assets. The idea of the grant is that NASA has a wide variety of remote sensing assets that should be applied to societal benefit, and let's develop strategies to do so. Once we determine the land surface temperature using these remotely sensed techniques, we layer them with identified risk factors, socioeconomic and sociodemographic data at the census tract level. And these include, for the cities that we're working with, minority populations, lower income, et cetera. And we calculate the density for those census tracts by removing all the non-residential locations. So this actually takes into account just the residential portions and the thermal imprint of just that section of the census tract. And we do a retrospective analysis of death certificates that have geocoded locations of death to look for the convergence of these factors. And the analysis proceeds initially with a logistic regression analysis, and then it gets fed into the black box, which I don't understand at all. This is the neural network approach, which classically is a black box. It's supposed to be impenetrable, I guess. But the ideas are that it's an iterative approach that learns the best fit of the models through this iterative approach, and to develop the best fit. And this is our outcome that identifies, stratifies the different census block group levels into different risks. And the dots on the map are the locations of deaths. It's an extremely data-intensive, time-intensive way of getting at this. And interestingly enough, when we were at a meeting, we showed this to a City of Philadelphia Health Department official. And he says, "Oh, it looks just like my lead map." He said, "I could have told you this a couple weeks ago without going through all that." But we had to learn the hard way. But this is one of those approaches that has a lot of merits for areas that are have an incredible amount of spatial heterogeneity. And we want to develop interventions that are operational on the very local level. So if we are to develop these plans, the idea is that we could engage through this community groups that know and can identify down to the census block group where the elderly people are, Meals on Wheels, for example, develop communication strategies that are extremely targeted towards these populations, even if there are difficulties in language. Uh-oh. Oh, let me go back. I think I'm missing a slide here. The second project I want to talk about is, and I'm sorry to Adele Houghton in the front, because it looks like the collaborator slide got dropped off, but this is another example of developing a data integration tool, matching health data with environmental data that can help guide policies, particularly climate mitigation and adaptation policy at the local level by an accommodation of health effects. And through Adele's leadership, we identified an opportunity with the Austin Climate Protection Plan to help guide and develop a public health indicators tracking tool that would be useful for their deliberations about which adaptation policies to put in place and where specifically in Austin to do that, that would link these health indicators with the mitigation strategies. Through a scan of the environmental hazards in Austin or Travis County, Texas, they identified flooding, severe weather, and drought as the major climate impacts that they wanted to address. And the tool that we developed is a environmental health indicators tracking tool that builds upon a tool called GEMS, which you can see on the lower left, which was developed by the local group TENRIS, Texas Natural Resources Group, that has a wide variety of environmental data already on it. This is many locations have this type of land use land planning tool available, and the idea was to then overlay some health metrics and vulnerability metrics to help them understand the variation between locations in these risks. And the object was to target policymaking priorities that would identify vulnerable places and populations so they could implement their policies in those locations. We'll talk about what those might be in the future, but also to raise awareness, you know, fundamentally in the community about the connection between their place and their risk for health outcomes from climate change. It's really important that we turn the dialogue about climate change away from polar bears and penguins and impacts distant in space and time to health effects that are happening in our community currently. And that's one of the basis for these tools is to bring it to home. And I think, as you can see, that, you know, what we're seeing with it, with the Austin Climate Protection Plan is that that message is starting to hit. So briefly, I don't have all the time in the world, but the layers of indicators go from exposure indicator, and in this case, this is a tool that's designed to be simple, designed to operate and be flexible in a wide variety of data situations. And the exposure indicator in this sense was the numbers of days of extreme heat events overlaid with the vulnerability indicators at the built environment, natural environment level, which includes vegetative cover at the vegetative cover and ambient surface temperature, overlaid with, again, the socioeconomic indicators that we discussed before. The health outcome data that we're using to start with, because of the signal that we could get in the data, is cardiovascular deaths 35 years or old, and next iterations of this system are going to accommodate heat-related deaths, respiratory deaths, et cetera, and to understand how those interact with heat events as well. And here's the outcome. The top map shows your social environmental health indicators, the distribution of those, and the bottom shows the age-adjusted cardiovascular mortality rate per 10,000 maps, and the confluence of those brings us to a map like we see on the very bottom. And this is some measure of risk at the local, at the census block group level, of the convergence of this age of mortality and heat exposure. And the same was done with the flooding tool. And the exposure indicator in this case would be heavy precipitation. Austin is in the flash flood alley, I think they call it. It's a lot of runoff, and urban areas consequently have a lot of impervious surfaces. And this is a major effect of heavy precipitation. You know, as the atmosphere warms up because of climate change, the turnover in precipitation is much faster and much more severe. The amount of heavy precipitation days that we will get is going to increase dramatically. So understanding how impervious surface interacts with heavy precipitation, extremely important. And the vulnerability indicators of place, in this case, were the 100-year floodplains and also the low water crossings. And the socioeconomic indicators that we identified were on the bottom. The age-adjusted mortality indicators, the health measure of this, was stress-induced cardiac arrest, either getting stuck in the water or dealing with flooding, trauma, injury, and accidental drowning and submersion. And what we get similarly to before, is a map like this. And this might seem abstract and pretty colors and all, but once you drill down to a really local level, it really can provide some very good guidance as to which areas in the city you're going to address with regards to your adaptation strategy. And here's an example. The top one is for temperature, and we mentioned before the really important effect that green space and evapotranspiration has on moderating those temperature extremes. And park plantings are a strategy that many cities, Chicago and others, have undertaken in order to cool the urban heat island, which not only reduces exposure to people, but also enhances or reduces our vulnerability to power grid failure during extreme events, because the energy demand is reduced as well. The bottom is an example of a flash flood vulnerability overlaid onto areas that are identified by EPA as having vulnerable streams. So targeting really spatially specific risks. And here's an example of how this plays out within the GEMS map viewer. And this is vegetative cover and overlaid, and this is more the downtown area, ambient surface temperature, then again the vulnerability to heat. This is an example of heat and death density and how those overlay to, say, end with a policy such as a park tree planting and a sidewalk master plan, and how this aids not only in the public health engagement with this issue, but engages outside of our sectors into other critical sectors that can help build a bridge between current climate adaptation efforts, which don't include public health, and give us a seat at the table. So, to conclude, I gave you a brief description of some adaptation strategies and ways in which we can engage these strategies for climate change, and it's important that we develop and test and expand these data-driven approaches that can identify spatially specific vulnerable populations and places, and also at the same time enhance our surveillance capacity by working towards better integration of environmental, meteorologic, and health data, and At the same time, identify the co-benefits for health and of mitigation and adaptation strategies by tying them to health outcome metrics. So thank you. And thanks to Adele.
Wow. Questions? Comments? Yes.
This is a question for George on his presentation. George, that's really great work you were showing in some of those projects, one with NASA and one with Adele in Austin. One thing I was wondering about, a lot of the heat watch warning systems were based on looking at mortality, the NASA project. What do you think about the idea of pushing that outcome down to some more sensitive outcome indicators, such as morbidity measures, such as hospitalizations and emergency rooms? One of the reasons I was thinking about that is you kind of miss some of the vulnerable groups. Usually the children, you don't see them. You don't see so many deaths from children, but some of the literature is showing that you're seeing more effects of children on hospitalization in the ER. Is there any effort or thought trying to, G-code those to address this? We only have, we're trying to push, the morbidity data down to lower and lower levels, but lots of states don't have it. We have it at zip code level in other places. Is that too much of a barrier or other being a problem?
No, I think if you're looking for health outcomes that
and
are
I hate to do this, but if you could rephrase the question and speak in the mic.
Rephrase the question, but I figured I'd come up with my own answer that wouldn't address the question. The idea was we're looking at very crude measures of health outcomes from heat waves, for example, mortality. And we know that if we look at the heat-related deaths that we've identified in Philly or Chicago or Phoenix, that we're only getting a tip of the iceberg. We really have to look at excess mortality from these events, or natural cause mortality, or some other measure to get a better sense of this. But even more accurate and perhaps more spatially specific and targeting other vulnerable populations would be the morbidity measures. It's not a reportable measure. It's very hard to get data on that, but it doesn't have to be nationally representative like we almost insist in some of our other systems. It can be locally tuned to local data sources. Perhaps one insurance or a couple insurance databases at the local level might provide the signal that you need in order to develop an effective policy. And in that sense, it doesn't. You could probably drill down much further. I think that's probably the next step. Paul leads our content working group for climate change indicators at or climate change tracking, and I think that's where we have to go next. To get those measures. The problem is that each locale has their own different data sources that aren't necessarily concordant.
Actually, I have a kind of a follow-up question to that, also data related, and maybe John, if you want to take a stab at this, what opportunities might there be to create or relate data that's relevant to epi surveillance pertinent to climate change with the Health Reform Act data resources? Is there something there? Is there an intersection or a synergy there that we ought to be pursuing?
I'm not sure I'm the better person to speak to this other than George, but certainly the requirement to be using electronic medical records is going to provide ultimately a rich data source that would be to some degree some kind of national equivalent of the locally distributed existing health insurance databases now. So there should be the ability to plumb down, but there are a lot of issues there of personal protection, and I think that the opportunity exists there. It will certainly help things, but I'm not sure if it's going to get us exactly where we need to go. George, have you looked at the issue of the healthcare reform bill? Anything to add to that?
Yes, thanks.
On that specific question of the relationship with the electronic record systems and tracking morbidity and mortality data, looking at the environmental changes over time. So you look at the DXs, the sum of the DXs over time. So in other words, I think that is going to be the best method of getting the clinical data, right? Tracking the clinical data over time and looking at the correlation between the clinical data and the environmental change. I say this from the standpoint that in island territories, because you know I'm from the Caribbean, our ecosystems are very, very complex and fragile. And so, for example, we had year before last, after 51 years, an outbreak of malaria in Jamaica. That's unheard of, right? And this was PFAS for malaria. Now, that came from Haiti. Now, because we have a lot of public health capacity, we could, in fact, control it. But the fact is, when we did our entomological assessment of the anopheles mosquito, we saw some very sort of weird patterns. But we know, for example, that within our small ecosystems, that the whole climate change has affected our fish catch off our shores. It has affected the nature of our ecosystems. And as a result of that, we are beginning to see very, very incremental changes in the pattern of diseases within our populations. And so, because this climate change issue is a global phenomenon, I think that there's going to be a lot of opportunities, and there must be a lot of opportunities, where those of us in academia in the Caribbean, who should be able to look at some of these, where we can see these incremental changes more rapidly than, for example, a big country like the United States. For example, if we use coal as an energy thing, right? In no time, a 144-mile long and 44 square, it would just completely destroy our ecology and make us not viable for economic development. So what I'm saying is that perhaps looking at what you're doing, which is, you know, excellent, there could be some correlation by looking at a different kind of ecosystem, right? That where you can get quicker changes in morbidity and mortality. And this, in fact, was a project that we started with the Europeans, but we could get funding for it. But we have our electronic health record system and a web-based system. And so therefore, I think from that standpoint, once we have portability of data, etc., across jurisdictions, HL7 compatibility for compliance, etc., we could immunize that data so that you all could get that data, we could get it, and we'll be able to do the mitigation and the adaptation.
Thank you. A strong support for electronic medical records. Greg?
I just have a response to that.
Yeah, do
you. You know, when we talk about ecosystem changes, I don't know if any of you had a chance to drive up into the mountains, but in a lot of the western states and going up into Canada, we've had over the last several years a big outbreak of pine beetle infestation. So you see a lot of rust-colored pine trees. And the thought is that as the climate warms and the winters don't experience those severe, you know, as severe cold temperatures that used to kill the beetle, now the beetle doesn't die off every year. And so it just continues to propagate. Now it's spilled over onto the Front Range. And so that's another example of.
Thanks. Question, yes.
You know, the evaluation component of this is, we haven't got there yet. There are some folks in the room, however. Mary, could you answer that question?
We're trying to better understand how is that, what we're calling differential vulnerability, so that we know that even within neighborhoods, there are people who are more vulnerable than others, and trying to better understand how we go about that.
So I'm going to follow up with a broader question. Don't go away. In general, how do we address resiliency, whether it's at an individual basis or a neighborhood or a community sense, as you identified and as was just discussed, we can face the same insults but have different responses.
Well, with climate change, the concept of community resiliency to natural hazards, I think, has to be rethought. We're considering developing communities that are not exposed to 100-year floodplains, when all of a sudden we're not dealing with 100-year flood events. Those are going to be 10-year flood events. And instead of having communities be able to be resilient to some initial state, that initial state doesn't exist anymore. We have to accommodate the concept of resiliency being a process of change, and not how quickly can we get back to that same vulnerable state that we were in the first place. But it's how we can move into a new situation where our urban environment is more robust and more, and it has transformed because of the impact of climate change. It's a state transformation rather than a kind of a rubber band approach, how quickly and our systems can respond to that. I don't know how we do that.
There's another element to this, which is if we had put up the graphic of all of the different health impacts of climate change, we would be seeing asthma, heat stress, air pollution effects, infectious diseases. And for virtually all of the health impacts of climate change, we know that the people who are most vulnerable are those with underlying diseases. And so one of the key aspects of resiliency, and we're at the Association of American Public Health Association, we've been trying for many, many years to get the resources to address health disparities, to address the basic fundamental health needs, access to care, removing health disparities. That has to be one of the fundamental principles of improving the resilience of our populations to increasing stressors. And in fact, in the President's Climate Adaptation Task Force report, I mentioned that one of the key recommendations was this idea that we need to be looking at adaptation policies for their inadvertent health impacts. The other, and we open ourselves as a community to criticism that we're being self-serving, but the other recommendation that we did put in there was that the best way to improve the resilience of the population in the United States is to address health disparities, to improve fundamental public health infrastructure, to assure that we're decreasing the prevalence of diseases like diabetes, cardiovascular disease, lung disease, to reduce the number of vulnerable people.
Yes.
So it's relatively easier to capture and geocode climate data. It's very hard to capture repeatedly vulnerable community data. And in such projects, typically, we see that they work very well for well-established communities where access is not a problem. To follow this temporally or differentially, as I just heard, it's going to be extremely difficult for you to really go to a Hispanic neighborhood or a Asian Pacific Islander neighborhood where people don't necessarily give you access to it. How do you plan to address that?
Jeez, I don't know. Are you speaking about the static nature of these maps and how we can accommodate changing characteristics of neighborhoods?
Well, to repeatedly follow a track over a course of a certain period of time,
mm-hmm.
4 years, you need to go into a sort of predictive state of getting at least on average a characteristic of neighborhood. And that's very challenging because you are not able to access these people.
Right. Well, we don't. I mean, these are static maps that the audience are policymakers that are developing these climate action policies in the first. In the first example, it's a static map. It's one of the drawbacks of that approach is that it provides a snapshot in time. And the presumption is that those vulnerabilities wouldn't change too much. They should be. And this is part of the evaluation and testing part of the map, is that how much spatial temporal change is there within each one of those units, and how do we address that? But in the first, given that the policymakers, it's at a local level, would implementation timeline of their actions is consistent with the timeline of population changing, that perhaps periodic assessments would accommodate that, because this provides a direction a 5-year plan or 10-year plan. But then when we go to look at that plan, you'd probably have to reevaluate that. I don't know how you get back into the neighborhood and really truth it. Maybe we could bring that up. Adele, want to address that?
I just wanted to mention that we have a poster tomorrow from 4:30 to 5:30 that actually focuses just on the tool itself. And a lot of the questions that are talking about data collection and tools, I would be really happy to talk to you all tomorrow. I don't want to take the space right now.
Great, thank you so much. So speaking of time and things that change over time, all three of you, but I want to start really with Greg. How do you ensure that that the policy leadership remains as administrations change? And that's something that Denver has dealt with fairly successfully. Can you share why?
Denver is generally a pretty reliable place to work if you're in the area of natural resources and the environment. Denver tends to be very democratic. So when administrations change, clearly management changes, the priorities change somewhat. But our hope is that as we move forward and we kind of establish that, you know, leadership role, we're active, nobody's going to want to really go back on that. Now, we can do a better job in Denver of integrating environmental health and public health, because we are two separate agencies, and going forward with the adaptation planning and the health messaging and getting people to understand that what's already happening is impacting their health, I think we have opportunities there. And we have some people who are in the running who really kind of get the public health side. So we're optimistic about the future.
Please join me in thanking all of the panelists and for a terrific presentation.